Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from Edvest and You, a loan product of the NEEF Network, a local nonprofit agency providing college student loans and student loan refinancing options. Information online at nhstudentloans.org or by calling 1-855-887-5430.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Every working American has a story about how the coronavirus pandemic affected their jobs. Some were suddenly unemployed as large swaths of the economy shut down. Some faced new danger of virus exposure on the job, and some switched to working from home. Today in The Exchange, we're looking ahead at the future of work. Listeners, join us. How has your job changed since March? What are your hopes and fears for work and the workplace down the road? Our email is exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Our phone number is 1-800-892-6477. Our guests are Kathleen Davis, deputy editor of fastcompany.com, also Jeff Feingold, editor of New Hampshire Business Review, and Bill Rogers, professor of public policy and chief economist at the Heldrick Center for Workforce Development at Rutgers University. Welcome to all of you. And Professor Rogers, I'll start with you. It's often been said that this pandemic has put into sharp focus the gap between America's haves and have-nots, whether it's healthcare or housing or education, and your field of study, work, Professor Rogers. So how do you summarize this?
Well, prior to the pandemic, there really have been three major trends that have been reshaping how we work, where we work, with whom we work, and when we work. And those were globalization, immigration and trade, technology. And during the 1990s, it was the information systems, the barcode, and now it's robotics. And then the third is the browning of America and also the aging of America, population diversity. But and those forces were helping out in some aspects, but also generating growth in income inequality and income insecurity amongst many Americans. And the pandemic, particularly with the shutting down the economy, really just showed how those risks that have been emerging over the last 30 to 40 years, as you said, just came really into sharper focus. For many, yeah.
No, go ahead, Professor Rogers. Keep going, please.
Yeah, sure. Just so for and it had a racial component to it, and that was even further brought out with the murder of George Floyd, with people protesting economic and criminal injustice, but also economic injustice. And it was interesting looking at the folks who were out peacefully protesting. It was much more diverse in the past. And part of that is because many of the challenges that African Americans and Latinos have been facing, more and more white communities and white families have been facing the prospects of the effects of globalization, getting outsourced, or having your job outsourced, or mental health issues around addiction.
See what you have learned, Professor Rogers, what data you've got on two counter trends. And I know you've written about this, one being people of color more likely to lose their jobs in this pandemic. The other, though, being, and I'd love to hear what you've seen, those who have remained on the job face more risks from the virus.
Right. So your first point, prior to this pandemic recession, the typical sort of dynamic is that African Americans and Latinos, and particularly young, less educated minority men, they're the first ones out when the economy turns down. And as we're seeing right now, potentially they're going to be the last ones in as the economy does tend to recover. And then on your second point, many African Americans, Latinos, and women, right? Because this has been one of my colleagues who runs the Institute for Women's Policy Research. She calls this a she session, that if you look at the drops in the share of people who are employed, women, especially minority women, have taken the biggest hit. And that's largely because, and it's not necessarily race specific, but it's just that these groups are employed or were employed in the occupations that have the high touch, right? They're nurses, working in retail and grocery stores, and then also as I said, healthcare workers, but also working in the leisure hospitality industry. And that 1 month in like April, I believe it was, you know, we shed basically 7 million jobs in retail, in leisure and hospitality. And then if you add in the retail trade, that was almost, I think about 40% of the job loss was in those occupations that, again, have a disproportionate representation of women and minorities. So they really took this double hit, right? Lost jobs, and they also were on the front lines in terms of being exposed to the virus.
Well, and given all these shifts that we've seen, we're going to talk this hour about how work and the workplace and the way that employers and society at large think about work. But just looking back to how everything, you know, has changed, and we heard Jeff Feingold, Professor Rogers' description. Broadly speaking, Jeff, what has the pandemic showed us about work here in New Hampshire? Jeff Feingold, are you with me? Okay, we seem to have lost our connection with Jeff, so we will go back to Jeff as soon as he's with us. Kathleen, how about you? You've written that the pandemic has pushed the future of work ahead 20 years in directions we were going anyway. So give us your big picture on that, Kathleen, please.
Yeah, so we've written a lot at Fast Company about the future of work, and a lot of these things, as you say, we kind of predicted, and in fact, we recently predicted that these changes would be coming in the next decade, 15, 20 years, which is the move to more remote work. And that, you know, we've obviously kind of been pushed there much quicker. And, you know, I think we're seeing it in a lot of, you know, we cover a lot of what's called the knowledge economy, right? So like office workers. And for a long time, there's been a lot of industries, publishing, for example, that are really resistant to work remotely and work from home. And the pandemic made it so they can't be resistant to it anymore. It kind of forced the hand of a lot of those sorts of businesses to scramble and figure out how they could do remote work.
So some of these trends were on the way anyway. In addition to working remotely, Kathleen, what else in terms of, you know, stuff that you guys were keeping your eye on and said, yeah, this will be here, but it may be 20 years and now it's here right now?
Yeah, remote work is the big one. But if you think about it, the ripple effects of remote work ripple out to how our cities are comprised, you know, when people, and we're seeing that a lot with companies like Facebook and Twitter that are now saying, they're allowing their workforces to work remotely completely. Well, those companies are based in San Francisco or New York, or Seattle, these very expensive places to live. And so when the employees start to not have to all be concentrated in those areas, then that changes the makeup of what cities are going to look like, what America is going to look like. And it also kind of opens up the hiring pool. And, you know, what we hear companies complain about a lot is the pipeline and everybody has to be concentrated in a certain area. And that really is a loss of opportunities for people who cannot afford to live in those areas or who don't happen to live in those areas. And when your hiring pool is now all of America or even all of the world, it really opens things up.
Oh, that's really interesting. So two threads that we'll definitely pick up on: how this opens up the hiring pool and the way that our communities are set up, given that some companies are completely going to work at home. But Jeff Feingold is back with us. And Jeff, what do you think? What has the pandemic showed us, taught us about the nature of work here in the Granite State?
Well, you know, I think there's two different tiers of this. I mean, I think for a lot of us who work out of offices, I think a lot of our employers have realized that they don't necessarily need offices all the time. I think some companies, I know where I work is, we've been working remotely for months now. There are some people who prefer to be around others, but we get the work done. And I think they realize that this can be done. We can work remotely, whether it's not 5 days a week, but you don't actually need to have everyone together in cubicles or wherever it's going to be, because those aren't exactly the safest things to have anyway nowadays. Yeah. So that's opened the eyes also. But the other thing is just people who work in at supermarkets and retail and all that has not changed that much, and it does raise issues about health and safety conditions. And I think a lot of those employers are rethinking how they set these things up, because going into the future, that's going to be a major concern for all employees.
It's, right.
You know, and I would hope for employers as well.
Yeah. Well, and what about the wage gap, Jeff? You know, one of the nice things coming out of this pandemic has been the deep and sincere appreciation that the public at large has for, you know, retail workers and, you know, delivery people, in addition to, of course, the healthcare workers who are absolutely on the front lines. But have we seen, as a result of this appreciation, Jeff, a narrowing of the wage gap?
There's just this temporary narrowing, I guess you would call it a narrowing, with you know, this extra pay for health frontline healthcare workers. And for a while, they were giving it to people who worked in some supermarket chains, were giving it to their supermarket workers and similar companies. But as far as it's a longstanding change, I don't think we haven't seen it yet. We may see it. I think there might be some policies at the federal level that might be able to, you know, work on this, because I think people's eyes were opened by the reality that happened when we had the enhanced unemployment benefits in New Hampshire, you know, federally of $600 a week, and that's employers are still dealing with that. With that, you know, when $600 a week sounds like a lot of money, but it's really not that much money, really. I mean, it is, but you know, it's been a lot of money for people who have been making minimum wage or $10 or $12 an hour. It's a much higher wage. And they're choosing to say, well, I'm not going to work because I'm actually making more money by not working. I think their eyes are open about the reality of their workforce, of their employment conditions. So maybe in the long term, it might change. There might be upward pressure on wages. But right now, from what I understand, wages are going down.
That, wow. Workers are
being paid less coming back nationally. And that's not a good sign at all, because wages were very high to begin with.
Well, Professor Rogers, what do you think? How much has this, you know, heartfelt public appreciation for frontline workers translated into dollars?
Well, it's really difficult to assess that right now because, for example, in New Jersey, where I serve on Governor Murphy's Restart and Reopening Committee or Commission, we've moved to stage two, but and that is a meaning that we've moved further along the reopening process. But still, what that is entailing, it's entailing that you know, only like 25% capacity. If you're having like retail or people coming into your store shop, and then in terms of let's say restaurants or other types of those types of leisure activities. Right, that we want them to be outside because we found that that the transmission effect is less when you're outside in sort of warmer areas and breezier areas. So, you know, as Jeff said, I mean, there's been a great deal of lifelines that have been thrown to Americans or bridges to the recovery. And just to add on to that, the concern that I have is Congress has passed what's called the HEROES Act, which would extend unemployment insurance, but use triggers. That is, when the economy really starts to, in good faith, recover, that then you would start to wean the effects, as opposed to what the administration has been doing. Is they, you know, they've been saying, well, let's just watch and see what happens. Over the weekend, the good news, it does seem like they do want to. They're ready to start negotiating because they realize that yes, we've had two good jobs reports over the last 2 months, which suggests that we have bottomed out, but you also have right what's going on in the South and Western states where there's flare-ups in, like in Texas and Florida, where either they've had to formally pull back on their reopenings, or just even people themselves, right, are not wanting to consume because they don't want to get sick. So, you know, it's tough. There's been a great deal of effort, thrown a lot of money. I don't want to say thrown because that sounds irresponsible, but there's been a great deal of support. The other area that we're getting concerned about as economists or policy analysts is state and local. I'm not sure what's going on in New Hampshire, but I assume if you're like New Jersey and other states, your state government is facing a major budget deficit. And the unique thing about right states is they can't print money,
right?
So the only
unlike
other
the
way,
federal government,
right? And the only other way that they can really raise revenue to pay for firefighters, teachers, and other also very important essential workers is you either have to raise taxes. and that and there's clearly no environment or appetite to do so. So that's another piece that's got to come forward. Otherwise, we're going to see a second wave of layoffs, and these are positions too that many women and minorities are found, and they also got themselves into the middle class. So this is one area where we may see income hits, and you know they're a major portion of the economy, whether it be providing essential services or just even their size. So that could have a negative effect on pay. And as Jeff said, before the pandemic, you know, many of these families were already facing greater risk. Risk because they had less disposable income,
Well, it's fascinating, Professor Rogers, that you serve on the governor's restart or reopening committee in New Jersey. And I definitely want to ask all of you what workers and employers are thinking about as states, you know, move toward reopening and in some cases pulling back. So lots to think about there. But I also want to remind our listeners that you can join us today in the Exchange. Listeners, we are talking about the future of work in the near term and the long term. So tell us how your job has changed since the pandemic hit, if you still have a job. Also, as you think about the economy opening, what are your hopes for your own work and your own workplace? What evolutions do you hope to see coming out of all this? Again, our phone number here in the Exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. And we'd love to hear your stories this morning. Once again, it's exchange@nhpr.org. So Kathleen, to you first, but I want to hear from everybody. What are employers having to juggle or think about, Kathleen, as states ponder reopening, or as Professor Rogers reminds us, ponder pulling back? What are employers thinking about right now?
Yeah, so I'll focus again just kind of on office workers and that kind of knowledge economy, since those are the industries that we cover the most at Fast Company. Well, they're thinking about a lot. First, before we even talk about the office space itself and employees coming back or not coming back to the office space, I think they're thinking about rethinking benefits. That's a big issue. You know, we write a lot about these tech companies and startups that used to have a lot of these benefits that were really designed to keep you in the office, right? Like completely free meals, you know, really interesting, fun office spaces to be in. Well, those things are no longer important. The things that are important to people now, especially our healthcare, but increasingly, I think the elephant in the room whenever we have any of these conversations is childcare. So in many parts of the country, it's been a big question mark what's happening in the fall. There's right now there's no summer camp or there's limited summer camp. If employees don't have childcare, how can we expect them to come back to work? So I think that's a big thing that employers should be thinking about if they're not. And then also I think another trend, as we were talking about earlier, of like how work is changing, and this is maybe not a great trend, is kind of a move towards more accelerating the current ongoing trend of independent contractors instead of W-2 employees. I think in a method to cut costs, a lot of employers will be looking at having more freelance employees rather than having people on the payroll.
Oh, that's interesting, Kathleen. So like you said at the beginning, a lot of the trends that have been sort of happening anyway got accelerated. So more gig workers, more freelancers, Kathleen.
Yes, yeah, exactly. And for the people that are keeping their jobs, and you know, as employers are grappling with, you know, do they want to bring people back to the office or not? You know, as I was saying, with the trend towards remote work and the changing, you know, faces of the cities and everything, I think, you know, there's the point of these office spaces are really expensive, you know, especially in these cities. I think a lot of employers will be looking at, like, do we want to keep paying the lease on these big office spaces, or is that a place to cut money? But if they are keeping their office spaces, I think what office design will look like is going to be radically different.
Wow. Blowing up a lot of cubicles, Kathleen, it sounds like.
Yeah, I think you know, there's been the trend for open offices for a long time, and they've kind of gotten away from what they were meant to be used for. And I think it'll kind of go back to that a little bit more. There'll be more open spaces for people to work. I think we're going to see common spaces like cafeterias repurposed. I think, you know, and another trend of how people are going to be coming back to work is like Facebook, for example, is doing this, is people coming back in waves, 20% at a time, doing staggered schedules where you come in a few days a week, things like that.
Yeah, which schools are also talking about. We did have done multiple programs this summer on schools and parents listening to you talk about staggered, you know, workplaces and staggered schools. We'll talk about childcare in a moment, Kathleen, because that's a big, big issue. But I want to get you, Jeff, and Professor Rogers, too, in on this question. And you first, Jeff, please. What are employers here in New Hampshire thinking about, grappling with as they want to reopen? But, you know, some employees are nervous, maybe customers are nervous. In certain parts of the state, you can only operate at 50% capacity. So what are employers having to just juggle right now, Jeff?
Well, first of all, they have to deal with the willingness of their employees to come back to work. You know, if employees do have the ability to decide that. I know that you have, as Kathleen was saying, you know, you have these staggered work hours where people who are just slowly getting back into opening their offices. Their people are coming in for a couple days a week at a time. Not everybody comes in. At the same time, you make sure you have, you know, you have all these health and safety procedures there, including you making sure you have sanitizers. People get their temperatures checked before they walk into the office. There's limited ability for people to travel other places, as part of their employment. So they are adapting that way. That's in the office. You know, the offices are one way of looking at it. There are other, you know, other work environments. And I'm thinking something about that doesn't really get that much attention is manufacturing. Now, you know, Kathleen was talking about how in a lot of ways we can all envision the offices that people work in changing in the future, that maybe you won't need as much space because employees might work remotely. So they won't all be in the same big office anymore. So you can use a smaller office, that kind of stuff. But in terms of manufacturing, in some cases, some of these manufacturers are going to need more space.
Right, to spread people out, Jeff.
Yeah. Exactly. So we have seen that already in New Hampshire during COVID, you know, most manufacturers in New Hampshire were considered essential businesses, mm-hmm. and they were open. But they had to change the way they had used their space because they needed to have the 6 feet apart. And in many cases, that was almost impossible at first because the way they designed their manufacturing process. And also they had to set up things like, you know, the plexiglass that you see in the supermarket or when you drive to go to the drive-up window at Dunkin' Donuts, they have that between the employees. They have, very frequent testing of the employees over a period of time. They make sure they take in their temperatures when they go from one part of the building to the other. It's very much the focus on safety, which is always pretty high in most manufacturing, environments, is even higher now. And I actually don't see that changing at all. I think that what's going to happen is that we'll see perhaps a need for even bigger manufacturing facilities in the future.
Interesting.
And it's got interesting implications for real estate going forward.
Yeah, less office space and more manufacturing. And how about you, Professor Rogers? And again, it's so interesting that you're on the New Jersey Restart Committee. What are employers saying about just, you know, what they need to think about as they reopen or decide to hold off?
Yes, Kathleen and Jeff did a really good job of summarizing those points that we are seeing or hearing our members who were from the private sector, or really all sectors, even the private sector, third sector. But I think the overarching theme here is what Governor Murphy says, is that public health will create economic health. And those states that were willing to put public health ahead of economic health, they're doing better now. New Hampshire, New Jersey, New York, right? These are these cities that are states that were willing to or saw that the benefits of fixing their public health dominating or trumping the economic health, that they're doing better now. And what that really means is creating a safe workplace for your employees, but also a safe place for your customers, right, to be able to come. I think, you know, whether, you know, how permanent will the changes, as such as, you know, no more bullpens or the end of the cubicle, that's really going to, I think it's also going to hinge on how fast we get a vaccination. From my listening to the public health people and the folks who are on our commission that are in healthcare, you know, the typical sort of time to a vaccine is around 4 years. But because there's a lot of teamwork, because there's a lot of efforts going on nationally, but also globally, you know, that it's, people are saying, you know, one and a half years, you know, is not out of the realm. And so if you do get a vaccine, quicker, sooner than later, you know, that will potentially, you know, sort of mitigate, I think, some of these changes that we are talking about.
Well, coming up, more on the future of work, and we'll look more at childcare that you mentioned, Kathleen. Also, unemployment insurance, the role that it has played and might play. Plus, your stories. Listeners, tell us how your work has changed in the past 4 months and what your hopes and concerns are moving forward. Our phone number is 1-800-892-6477, and we'd love to hear from you. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR. The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, the future of work. Since March, many Americans have found their employment transformed. Job losses, teleworking, new safety procedures, and some dangers for essential workers. We are looking at the future of work this hour on The Exchange in the near term and long term. And Exchange listeners, tell us how your job has changed or if you lost your job. Also, what are your hopes? What are your fears for how work and the workplace might evolve as a result of all this? Our email address is exchange@nhpr.org. Use Facebook or call in 1-800-892-6477. We're talking with Kathleen Davis, deputy editor of FastCompany.com, also Jeff Feingold, editor of New Hampshire Business Review, and Bill Rogers, professor of public policy and chief economist at the Heldrick Center for Workforce Development at Rutgers University. One more time, that number, 1-800-892-6477. And all of you, Taylor's calling in from Nashua. Hi, Taylor. Thanks for being on the air with us today. Go ahead.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Sure.
So, my job is very technology heavy, and I've noticed basically as we've had to continue working under COVID-19 conditions, we've seen them testing a lot of combination of positions and basically trying to see how few people can do basically everything they need to essentially get done.
Oh, wow.
And this worries me. Yeah, this worries me a little bit. I mean, most of it's pitched as like contingency should someone get sick and we not have the workforce to be able to replace, like, you know, someone being out for extended period of time. But I do wonder about, like, if this is kind of a trial run for, you know, corporate. Maybe they see that, oh, well, this position could technically be done by, you know, this less amount of people. So I don't know. I'm kind of worried about that, is that the, you know, things used now to get by might be detrimental to workers and having like a healthy staff going forward.
Wow, Taylor, thank you for calling in. And I hear your concerns. And Kathleen, what do you think? You guys cover a lot of tech companies.
Yeah, I think that your concerns are kind of everybody's concerns right now in a broader sense of everybody who is lucky enough to have kept their job is kind of scrambling to feel like I need to prove my worth, right? Of especially when you're remote, I think there's that extra pressure of I need to be on more. I need to show how much I'm doing. I need to show my value because the issue is when you're in the office, you know, there's this thing of like FaceTime of showing that you're sitting at your desk working. And when you're not in the office, I think a lot of employees feel like they need to show that they're working because their boss can't see them. And I think it's a totally valid fear also that, you know, your office seems to be kind of trying to streamline things. I don't have the answer as far as like, does your particular office going to eliminate positions? But I think it's a position that a lot of people are in of fearing that a lot of companies are looking at ways to cut costs and, you know, and thinking about redundancies in jobs.
Wow. So Kathleen Taylor talked about sort of squeezing jobs, you know, from two down into one maybe or something. What about robotics and automation, Kathleen? You know, is there a concern there among sort of the office workforce or the more technical workforce that they could be automated away?
Yeah, I think that's a fear, you know, that's another trend that again was a, you know, a decade or so out, but, you know, we've been working towards of the fear of automation losing jobs. And you hear about that a lot in, you know, the service economy or in manufacturing of literal robots being able to do your job, right? And you think that it's not maybe as possible for knowledge workers, but increasingly there are AI programs that can, you know, automate kind of knowledge work. Will that trend be accelerated now? That I'm not so sure of. I think now everybody's kind of in scramble mode as far as trying to protect the bottom line and protect their, you know, how much money they're losing. I don't know that automation right now is the biggest fear for the knowledge economy. I think that right now it's kind of the reconfiguring of the workforce itself.
Well, Professor Rogers, what are you seeing, especially in terms of those workers who, you know, have to get up and still leave the house and go to the grocery store or go to the nursing home? What are people in that sector saying about robotics and automation and so forth?
Well, prior to the pandemic, we were seeing an uptick in particularly the application of robotics, particularly in manufacturing and related industries. There was a little bit of a dip during the Great Recession from 2007 to 2009. And so Kathleen was saying, yeah, there was this trend was rising or expanding. And some work that I had done with Richard Freeman, a colleague from Harvard, for the Century Foundation, we found that over that period of time, from I believe like 2004 to 2015, 2016, I believe, that you had several things going on. You had, if you were young, less educated minority and you lived in the Midwest, you had a much higher likelihood of losing your job due to the sort of presence of robots. But the good news was that we had that time over this period, we had a strong, relatively strong economy, and it seemed to be creating opportunity in other industries. So if someone lost their job in an industry where robots came in, because of the strength of the economy, they were able to find a job elsewhere. And then the other issue too that was occurring that seemed to offset some of the potential job loss was, as Taylor was saying, basically his employers trying to make workers more productive, and so that then can generate new other types of jobs, right? That spin off because of the innovation from the robots. But the troubling thing that I hear in Taylor's comment is that it's independent of technology. It's across so many sectors, and that is worker voice, right? That how we come out of this pandemic and how workplaces are reshaped really is going to depend upon how much workers have in terms of their voice. One way that workers get voice is being members of unions or being covered by a union contract, and the percentage of workers, right, covered by union contracts has fallen dramatically since the 1980s. And so that's one of my big fears is that we see employers and we see public policymakers wanting to say we're going to have an inclusive recovery, that we're going to have a shared recovery where we're going to increase compensation as a share of GDP. It's going, because it's been trending down for most workers. And so the places where workers or employees have more voice, have they're at the table, the bargaining table, the conversation, not even so much the bargaining table now, but really the table about how is our workplace going to be reconfigured such that it promotes public health, but also promotes a sense of economic justice. That's the key question going forward, and especially because of the murder of George Floyd, right? That even adds in the racial and the gender and the class aspects of employees needing more say in the workplace, and that doesn't mean in a negative way, because when you talk about unions, many people, their hands go up or their hair on the back of their head goes up. Oh my gosh, giving workers more voice is a problematic. But you know, if you go back to sort of the most or successful companies, some of the most successful companies such as Costco, they're unionized and they do quite well. So worker voice can actually be a win-win for the managers and for workers.
Well, that's interesting. And Jeff, I want to turn to you too. We again heard Taylor's concerns, and I did want to ask you about what you're seeing in terms of robotics and automation in the New Hampshire economy. Maybe you can talk about manufacturing, Jeff, especially. Because, you know, those are the so-called good jobs in New Hampshire, you know, solid, yeah. Steady, good benefits, good pay. You can count on them.
Yeah. Right now, well, there are obviously manufacturers in New Hampshire have been using robotics for many, many years. And in some ways, New Hampshire manufacturers don't use it as much as you see in these massive manufacturing facilities. We don't have that many of those.
Ours are smaller, but Jeff, is that what you're saying?
Yeah, they're smaller. They're smaller work environments. They have processes that still need people, but they do use robotics, obviously. And my feeling on robotics, though, is that this whole the pandemic has really opened the eyes of employers on the need for health and safety. And it's my feeling, but I think that might push them to using more robotics because of what they would see as perceived safety. You know, health and safety issues involved with using robots as opposed to human beings. But that's just my own feeling, and I don't want to get people jumping off the roof on that, but I think that is a possibility. The other thing I wanted to say about what the professor said about unions, you know, he makes a really good point, because I think in some ways the last several months a lot of employees have seen their need to be empowered as a community, and they can't just work on issues individually. They have to join together, whether they're working, you know, you saw employees at supermarkets, in various companies. I'm not going in unless you make sure that's a safe workplace. You know, that's something that you would do as a union, but they don't have unions. And I think that in some ways that's opening the eyes of employees, and it's also the opening eyes of unions of different workplaces where they hadn't been able to organize workers, that they might be able to see, well, you know, maybe there's a possibility, because these employees see that they need to have, a unified voice in some cases. And I think going forward, that might be a good thing. It's definitely would be a good thing for the employees at this point, because, you know, it's been, study after study has shown that the reason we have, pretty much stifled wage growth is because, you know, it's tied pretty much to the demise of the union movement in the United States.
Well, and as a customer, nobody wants to eat at a restaurant or shop at a grocery store where people are, you know, possibly sick. So there's sort of a circle of benefits there to what you're saying, Jeff. Otto wrote us an email. Otto says, I'm an engineer at a manufacturing plant. We've just been talking about that. And we have remained open during the pandemic. Most of our office staff moved to work from home with one person from each department in office to make sure we can interact with the manufacturing floor. Otto says, it's been an interesting couple of months. Our machines are all 6 feet apart, so we've been fortunate on that front. For us, the more problematic element is that incoming sales have been down, as much of what we produce goes to auto and aircraft manufacturers, and they have not been open or producing at scale. Wow, Otto, that is a big deal, I'm sure. Otto says, we used the PPP loan first, but now we have moved to the New Hampshire Workshare, which is great that New Hampshire has it. Otto says, now it's basically a waiting game for us to see when other parts of the economy can safely come back too. Full disclosure, NHPR got a PPP loan as well. So that's interesting. There's Otto talking about what it's been like at his manufacturing plant. Got another email from someone who did not want to give a name. This person says, I work for a wealthy family, and during the pandemic, they decided that what would be best for themselves would be to take away their staff's benefits of health insurance and disability insurance. We were not allowed to take time off. We had to work without masks around them. Wow. They never stopped having parties. They never stopped having people over. And they exposed us to the virus all the time. Two of us on staff had to take another job to pay for our insurance. We are again exposed to COVID. We also have had no raises for 8 years, but we are not really skilled workers, and they know they can take advantage. And I want to also thank that person for writing in. And Professor Rogers, to you, you know, you talked about the importance of voice, but given low rates of union membership, especially here in New Hampshire, our rates are quite low. And given now that we have, I don't know what the latest numbers are, 13% unemployment. It varies by state. How much voice do workers really have? It sounds like this person has no voice at all.
Yeah, I mean, that's just shameful. There's no simple simple way to put it. I would just hope that that person is able to find safe employment elsewhere. They're not alone. And what's even more frustrating is that even though the economy prior to the pandemic was at a historical level, lowest unemployment rates, not for just a month, but for several years, and tremendous job growth, right? The stories or the shares of this person were growing, and in New Jersey, I've worked with the United Way here, and we developed this concept called ALICE, where ALICE stands for Asset Limited, Income Constrained, and Employed, and it's basically includes households that are, by the government's definition, below poverty, but it also includes those like this individual who potentially they're above poverty, but they haven't had pay raises. They may have issues around childcare. Their healthcare costs have been rising, and this has been going on, as I said, since the 1980s. It's just a growing pattern, and one of the things that we did was we've helped to try to educate the community and say, okay, for individuals like this, this is the challenge that they have for their housing. If they don't have good housing, this is what it means for that Alice family. This is what it means for that Alice family if they're not getting a pay raise, they're not able to pay for their health insurance, right? But we went one step further, and hopefully people who have the means that are listening, that to this person's share, and that what's happening to them, even though you may be wealthy or well off, that their economic insecurity impacts everybody else, right? That it's going to lead to potentially higher taxes down the road because we have to help to pay for their health insurance or their health bills because they had to go to the emergency room, right? There's just endless stories of how, right, that those individuals who are a growing share of our population, that they affect all of us. I mean, in New Jersey, about 38-39% of our households are ALICE. So it's not a racial thing. It's not a gender thing, right? It's we have an increasing share of families who are month to month, they're paycheck to paycheck. And again, this pandemic has just really brought these kinds of experiences out. And then just one last comment on Otto, what his share really is this testimony to how connected we are as an economy. And this is right. One reason why many people think that they don't think we're going to have a rapid V-shaped recovery. That is the rapid downturn we had in April, where New Hampshire's unemployment rate jumped to 17% from 2.4%, and then fell slightly in May to 14.5%. That we're going to have more of this Nike swoosh type of recovery, and it's going to be because, for an Otto's example, they're getting that the airlines are still trying to figure themselves out and recreate how or reimagine their workplaces. Or cars, the automobile industry that they're lagging.
Right. So a lot of his company contributes to that, and that
exactly.
Makes it, he doesn't
right?
have.
So
go ahead.
Yeah. It's just there's a lot of different analogies. You can do the domino, right. The little domino game, right? throwing the pebble in the water and right. seeing the ripple effects. But there are these, what we call multiplier effects. And those are being they're not being fully exploited. So that's why we're going to see a longer recovery. And then just back to the other person's share that, as you said, you know, we're paying for the inability as a society to really take care of each other. And that doesn't mean necessarily coddle someone. But what it means is, from a policy standpoint and as a caring society, really reducing the risk, the systemic risk that people face, because they just can't bear it. That's why you have social insurance.
After a short break, a couple more calls and emails. Thanks to that person who wrote in, didn't want to give a name. Otto, thanks to you too. Our email address, if you want to tell us how your work has changed, is exchange at nhpr.org and our phone number 1-800-892-6477. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, the future of work. Exchange listeners, let's hear from you. How has the pandemic changed your employment? What's better? What isn't? And how do you think society in general and employers in particular need to think about work differently? Send us an email. It's exchange@nhpr.org. You can use Facebook or you can call in 1-800-892-6477. We're talking with Kathleen Davis, deputy editor of FastCompany.com, also Jeff Feingold, editor of New Hampshire Business Review, and Bill Rogers, professor of public policy and chief economist at the Heldrick Center for Workforce Development at Rutgers University. One more time, that exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. And all of you, right back to our listeners. Tim is calling in from Portsmouth. Hi, Tim, you're on the air. Welcome.
Thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure. Go ahead, Tim. We lost you a little bit there, but go ahead.
I hate to be a contrarian, but I'm listening to this discussion about robotics and people losing their jobs and people having shortages of companies downsizing their physical number of jobs and stuff like that. And I work in this sector, the skilled service sector. Let's talking about electricians, plumbers, carpenters, painters, people like that. And I'm self-employed. And it's a small sector, but it's an important sector in our economy. And it's populated by middle-aged men and women. And there aren't enough young people going into that line of work to replace us as we age out. Like personally, I'm painting somebody's staircase in a mansion in Portsmouth, and I'm 68 years old. Wow. And I'm lucky to have a 22-year-old son that works with me, but if I could find another 22-year-old that was motivated and wanted to learn the trade, I would jump on that opportunity, but I can't. So I think it bears discussing that in addition to having all this massive disruption, we have some sectors of our economy, some jobs that are not filled and will never be. Nobody will ever do what I do. And most of those skilled service jobs that I described will never be taken over by a computer or artificial insemination. Yet people aren't beating our doors down to come and work with us. And I was wondering if it could be discussed a little bit.
That's Tim,
all. Thanks, Laura.
I'm so glad you called because this is so important. And Jeff Feingold, you and I had multiple conversations about this exact fact before the pandemic. Tim is absolutely right. You know, there's a strong need for people with skills like plumbers, electricians, bricklayers. We have a gentleman who's, you know, over the years done work on our house, and he's had a hard time getting someone to help him, and he would love the help. You know, he's in his mid-40s, so he'd enjoy someone doing some of the heavy lifting with him. What about this, Jeff? This is a big deal in New Hampshire, especially with our aging workforce.
Yeah, this has been something we've talked about many times on your show, Laura, is that this is something that's going on for literally decades in New Hampshire as we get older. And it is particularly apparent in, let's say, construction-related occupations, like Tim's, like painting, masonry, carpenters, electricians, and people in that, employers, businesses in that industry have been trying for years to convince younger people that these jobs are not just available, training's available to get them, but also that they pay really pretty well. And at this point, they haven't figured out a way to outsource that. You know, you can't, you know, fix a leak in your pipes remotely or anything. So these are jobs that really have staying power in this the way the economy is developing. And there is a lot of frustration, and I could see where Tim's coming from. I know many people like Tim in that age group who are still in this business, and it's hard work. You're using your body, and that's, you know, it, after you, you know, you're in your 60s and you want to retire, but you can't afford to. Obviously, as after what we've been through, not just with the pandemic, but the Great Recession and other economic hits in the lifetime of a 60-year-old, that it's really hard to retire. But it is also something that we've seen that there's there's like a disconnect between the need of these industries for employees and the the young people who just apparently have little interest in taking over these jobs.
Well, Jeff, maybe
there are many available. I mean, they're really, even in this recession, they are still very
absolutely. I mean, how many people have you talked to who said, you know, I've got something broken and I can't find somebody to come to my house and fix it? So, Jeff, maybe as we look towards the future, given that, you know, as you said, these jobs, you know, are there, they need workers, you can't, you know, replace with a robot somebody who's going to, you know, lay bricks on your sidewalk or fix your leaky sink.
Yeah.
Are these jobs going to become more interesting to a younger generation as we come out of this pandemic? Will young people start to go, you know, that job did not get shut down?
Yeah. And you know, there's a lot of factors in this. You know, first of all, as we've discussed through this show, you know, there's a lot of anxiety in a part of employees, of people who, of workers. And this is, you know, if you can somehow become, you know, someone with a skill who could be self-employed in many cases, you know, that's obviously an attraction. The other thing is that to get these kind of jobs, you don't need to go through the 4 years of college route and the $150,000 in debt and all that other stuff that we've been hearing about for many years. It's a much different route. It's a route that in many cases is funded by employers, by state and programs, by other training, apprenticeship programs. So it's just a different mindset. And I think I've really thought that this, what we've been going through, is going to have the same impact on how people think about their lives the way the Depression had on at least my parents' lives and my grandparents. It really does kind of change your mindset about what you want to do with your life and how you want to approach it.
Kathleen, I did want to ask you sort of head on about childcare, because you touched on it earlier. And, you know, everybody knows this pandemic has been, is it too much to say, Kathleen, a nightmare for parents who work outside the home with younger kids, schools closed, summer camps either closed or with limited capacity. We've done whole shows on this, Kathleen, but in terms of your expertise, you know, work and the workplace, how do you think this has changed corporate America's views of what it means to work and have a family?
Yeah, I don't think that nightmare is too strong of a word.
Not overstating it. Okay.
For a lot of parents. I mean, you know, for example, I have a 7-month-old and a 3-year-old, and it is very difficult to come home and care for children. And I think that that's what everybody is finding. And it's, you know, it's been covered a lot, as you say. You know, New York Times even had a big article about it over the weekend, that it's kind of this thing that's happening that everybody knows is awful, but nobody is coming up with a solution for. And the impact of that cannot be overstated. So the impact is kind of twofold. One is the impact that it's going to have on the childcare industry itself. So there, without government aid, without more government interventions, there's an estimated 4.5 million childcare slots that could completely disappear because, you know, daycares and preschools and childcare centers that can't remain open if they can't take children in are going to end up closing. And then the ripple effect that's going to have the effect on the people that work in that industry, but then the ripple effect that that's going to have when things do open up and people are looking for care for their children, there's just going to be less care. But so that's one kind of arm of it. And the other arm of it is that we are just expecting parents to do something that is literally, you know, a few months ago would have been thought of as completely impossible, to care for their children full time, to in a lot of cases teach their children, you know, be homeschool teachers, which is in itself a humongous full time job, and not compromise any of their productivity at work. Because, you know, as I was talking about earlier, everybody, and especially parents, are feeling this like extra pressure to show their value, to show their worth, to be extra productive, because they're being allowed to work from home. And a lot of employers are not being sympathetic to it. I think a lot of employers are just kind of expecting employees to somehow figure out how to do it, which is an ongoing, you know, it kind of speaks to the way that we've treated working parents for years, is just, yeah, childcare is unaffordable. Work-life balance is really hard. You figure it out. It's your problem. You're the one that had the kids. And for example, Florida State University recently told their employees that they're no longer allowed to work from home and care for their children at the same time. And of course, their employees are left going, well, what am I supposed to do? There's nowhere to send my children.
So it seems, Kathleen, that employers up until now had thought about, you know, childcare, that's your problem. As you said, you're the one who had the kids. But a society needs young people to, you know, stay vibrant. So I wonder, do you see moving forward, Kathleen, you know, companies saying, okay, maybe this is our problem. Maybe this isn't just Kathleen's problem.
I mean, hopefully. So right now what we're seeing happening is, again, parents kind of taking matters into their own hands. You know, we've written about some of the solutions that parents have come up with on their own, like podding, which means like you pick another family and you kind of decide that you're in a pod together of
right.
exposure, and you share childcare responsibilities. I think what's needed is, quite honestly, government action.
And Kathleen, I apologize. This is something we need to focus on again. Even though we've done a bunch of shows, I think once the fall approaches, we'll have to focus on it again. I do apologize for having to wrap you up there today. All of you, we could have kept talking for a long time. Thank you very much for being with us this morning. And you're listening to The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org or subscribe to our podcast. Search Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or Stitcher for NHPR Exchange.